this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And we'll start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline for the cover story, "You Better Get Ready to Pay More. Thousands of business owners brace for a hit on their P&L as new federal overtime rules go into effect December 1. And that's the article on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. The actual cover story article begins inside with a second headline. For employers, workers, this law will matter. In offices throughout the Triangle and nationwide, company owners and managers are staring at their profit and loss statements and wondering if 2017 is going to be a year that changes their company's employee structure. And this article is written by Richard Rogoski. Is it more expensive to increase the pay of exempt employees or pay them overtime, they're asking? Where will the money come from? How can companies develop talent and provide the flexibility employees want without breaking the law? All these questions are coming because of significant changes in the Fair Labor Standards Act. Come December 1, exempt employees earning less than $47,476 per year must be paid for overtime worked. The new level is more than double the existing threshold of $23,660 and is bringing more urgency and perhaps more honesty to discussions about balancing pay and work hours. The new rule now requires companies to pay their employees overtime if their salaries are below $47,476. What may be of a bigger concern for businesses is that the minimum threshold will be adjusted every 3 years, beginning January 1, 2020. But this rule, which covers what is commonly known as white-collar exemptions, does not apply to everyone. Among those excluded are physicians, dentists, lawyers, teachers, academic administrators, and outside salespeople. Also, companies under $500,000 in annual gross sales are exempt from this rule. The new rules are being challenged in federal court by 21 states, but North Carolina is not one of them. Companies, to ensure they are in compliance with the new rule, have some options. They can increase employee salaries to the new threshold, convert salaried employees to non-exempt status and begin paying overtime, or convert salaried employees to hourly workers, paying them the same wage but entitling them to overtime pay if they work more than 40 hours per week. If salaried employees are converted to hourly, the employer could also anticipate the overtime and reduce the base pay to take into account the overtime. In any case, making a salaried employee into an hourly wage earner will require accurate timesheets. This has already raised some questions among employers as to whether time spent at home, checking work-related emails, for example, constitutes time spent at work that needs to be recorded since it could eventually contribute to overtime. Also, employers, to meet the new threshold, can allow up to 10% of that new salary level to be in the form of non-discretionary bonuses, incentive pay, or commissions, as long as these are provided on a quarterly basis. Employers must be proactive. Those who have studied the changes say employers should be proactive as the changes approach. Patty Bartis, a partner in the Raleigh law firm Parker Poe Adams & Bernstein LLP, specializing in employment law, says the new rule's impact mostly will be felt by companies with lower-salaried workers, such as nonprofits, home health care agencies, restaurants, and retailers. But she also says companies may face legal challenges if they're not in compliance. Employees could either file a formal complaint with the U.S. Department of Labor, or they could sue the company. The danger is going to be a year from now, when a year's worth of overtime will have accrued, Bartis says. Another employment attorney, Diane Tyndall, a partner in the Raleigh office of Wyrick, Robbins, Yates & Ponton, LLP, says her firm has been offering seminars to clients, such as the North Carolina Bankers Association, to advise them on the new rule. The rule had not changed for so long, and all of a sudden we're playing catch-up, she says. Tyndall says companies need to assess their workforce and decide on a strategy. The simplest is to make more people non-exempt, she says. Keep their pay the same, but pay them overtime. But converting salaried employees to hourly workers could affect morale, she says. If you're put on hourly, you may think it's a demotion from your salaried status, she says. U.S. Labor Secretary Thomas E. Perez has defended the rules, which he said were based on sound legal and policy footing, and Tyndall believes the rules are likely to remain in place. Just my opinion, but I don't think the lawsuit will change the DOL, Department of Labor, decision, except perhaps to the extent that it mandates automatic indexed increases, Tyndall says, referring to the minimum threshold adjustment. The argument is that automatic increases will bypass the notice and comment requirements of the federal rulemaking process. Challenging for nonprofits. The uniqueness of nonprofit corporations prompted the DOL to issue a special fact sheet that covers who is and is not covered under the new rule based on the status of organizations and their workers. It also provides options that can be implemented to ensure compliance. David Heinen, Vice President of Public Policy and Advocacy for the North Carolina Center for Nonprofits, says, "It's going to have a very profound effect, and a lot of nonprofits already recognize that. We're going to have to cut workers and services." Heinen explains that only 6 counties, including Orange and Durham, have salaries for nonprofit employees that average above the threshold. Wake County, he says, is just below the cut at about $45,000. Most nonprofits are now doing internal audits, Heinen says, but face a limited number of options. Many non-exempt employees of organizations, such as those dealing with domestic violence or foster care work, a lot more than 40 hours per week, so to pay that much overtime would break the budget. Most nonprofits have such a tight budget that they work to have a balanced budget or slightly higher, he says. Plus, he notes, nonprofits can't raise prices to offset costs. In addition, those that operate under government grants or contracts would have a difficult time trying to renegotiate those deals to make up for higher operating costs. According to Heinen, one option for nonprofits is to scale back the number of clients they serve. But other options could be just as drastic. They could cut staff and pay more to those who are left, he says. They could hire more part-time employees, or they could push some of the work out to contractors. They need to come up with as many creative solutions as they can, he says. Food for thought. Restaurants also will feel the pinch under this new rule. Lou Machakos, owner of 1,965 worker LM Restaurants, and thus the Carolina Ale House chain of restaurants, says he's looking at his options and will make a final decision sometime in October. "We have entry-level managers who make between $38,000 and $40,000, he says. 30 to 40 managers will probably be affected. Most likely they will lose some of their benefits, or we may have to lay off some managers." Another option, Machako says, is to convert some of the salaried managers to hourly employees. However, he notes that this may create morale problems since, again, some may think of it as a demotion. Judy Irwin, Senior Vice President of Human Resources and Training for the Raleigh-based Golden Corral chain of restaurants, says a strategy is already in place but has yet to be implemented. Irwin says kitchen managers, those in charge of the food preparing staff, and hospitality managers, those in charge of the wait staff, are paid a salary plus an incentive that puts their pay above the threshold. But assistant managers are hourly employees who get paid overtime. To adjust pay levels to comply with the new rules, she says, the incentive percentage will change. PR firms to feel an impact. Rick French, chairman and CEO of the Raleigh-based public relations firm, French West Vaughn, says he has been monitoring the new rule for a long time. In fact, he says the PR and advertising industries had lobbied the DOL to drop the proposed rule. French says a number of his employees are already above the threshold, but the impact will be felt by the 12 to 15 at the junior or entry level. "Do we limit hours, pay overtime, or raise them to the threshold?" he says. The biggest challenge will be hiring college grads who are trying to enter the workforce, especially in professional services firms, he adds. There can be a drying up of entry-level positions. Raising salaries, however, also could impact the company's potential revenue. Clients are not going to accept additional charges passed on to them, French says. Strategic staffing. Billy Redmond, CEO of Trademark Properties in Raleigh, says only 4 of her 125 employees will be affected by the new rule. "We've moved 3 of those to hourly, and the 4th employee we moved to part-time," she says. Although Redmond's strategy won't be implemented until closer to the deadline, her employees have already been notified. They took it personally, she says. They almost felt like it was a demotion. I explained to them that it wasn't personal, it was regulatory. Another strategy that works, she says, is to balance the workload among employees to reduce the amount of overtime accrued by a single person. Cindy Heath, principal of Five Star Staffing and Accounting Recruiters in Raleigh, says her four salaried employees moved to hourly back in January. They were fine with it, she says. A significant change. Of course, this is not the first significant or even the most sweeping change in employment law. Overtime rules date back to 1938, and reforms under President Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal that established the 40-hour work week, minimum wage, and overtime regulations. The new rules were quite controversial during the Great Depression, and some raised concerns that it would negatively impact businesses. The minimum wage was set at 25 cents in 1938 and steadily rose, hitting $2.65 in 1978, $5.85 in 2007, and the current $7.25 in 2009. The coming changes date to March 2014, when President Barack Obama asked for a review of regulations. That drew some criticism, with the National Federation of Independent Business spokesmen calling it an anti-business policy. The news didn't draw huge attention, with the New York Times putting it on page A18. But now the changes are imminent, and Heath, a five-star staffing and accounting recruiter, says businesses must be ready. The concern I have is that a lot of smaller businesses may not know this is going to happen, she says. Are companies' CPAs or those doing their books making people aware? Now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. The main headline, Fateful Night in Wake County Impacted Arnold Palmer's Life. Arnold Palmer nearly died on the back roads of Wake County in 1950, and a crash that killed his best friend had a profound impact on Palmer the rest of his life. Palmer died September 25 at the age of 87 after one of golf's greatest careers. Palmer, from Latrobe, Pennsylvania, landed at Wake Forest College in 1948 because his friend and fellow golfer, Buddy Worsham, asked the Deacons coach if he'd take his pal too. Palmer and Worsham were together at a Wake Forest home football game on the afternoon of October 21, 1950, and planned to attend a dance in Durham that night. But after the game, Palmer said in a 1978 interview, "A couple of alumni came by with some joy juice, and after dinner that night, I went to bed. Bud tried to wake me up, but I just flat refused." Worsham and another student drove to Durham. Returning late that night, their car slammed into a narrow bridge over the Neuse River. Both died at the scene. "I had to identify the bodies the next morning," Palmer recalled. "It was the most horrible day of my life." A shaken Palmer left Wake Forest to join the Coast Guard. He returned to school 3 years later, but only briefly, winning the first ACC golf title in 1953. He never graduated and went on to professional golf. Palmer remained fiercely loyal to Wake Forest and often returned to speak to young golfers or to help raise money. Palmer also followed through on an idea he first had as a student, establishing and endowing a Wake Forest scholarship in Worsham's honor. Raleigh lawyer honors uncle by going over the edge. Don't look down. Brooks Pierce, managing partner Reed Phillips, says his decision to rappel down the Wells Fargo Capital Center September 30 was motivated by a personal cause. Pierce will join the Over the Edge Challenge for Special Olympics North Carolina. His uncle had Down syndrome. "He and I spent many hours together doing the hard work of farming on my grandparents' farm in Ohio, baling hay, feeding the livestock, harvesting and canning the vegetables from the garden, mucking out the barns and shoveling wheat and corn into the granaries," Philip says. "We all worked hard, but no one worked harder than my uncle. And he loved the Special Olympics. He participated every year, adding his new medals every year to the doorknob to his closet where he could see them every day until eventually there were so many that he had to lay some on his dresser." Raleigh apartment scene gets a new look. The former Palms apartments off of Lake Boone Trail in North Raleigh are now long gone and replaced with the new Sojourn Lake Boone apartment community that started welcoming tenants in April 2016, celebrating with a party for the new community on September 21, where the project's developer, Gordon Grubb of Grubb Ventures in Raleigh, his wife Sally, and Hal Jordan, owner of Harold K. Jordan & Company of Apex, the general contracting firm for Sojourn Lake Boone. We want bacon and pimento cheese. The North Carolina State Fair is right around the corner, which means it's time for lobster on a stick and a fried bacon pimento cheeseburger egg roll, right? Those are two of the new foods available this time when the State Fair begins October 14. And remember, advance tickets are available online until October 13. Buying tickets at the fair can be pricey once it begins. It's $1 per ticket, and rides usually take a bunch of tickets. You can buy 18 tickets for $10 in advance and also shave a few dollars off the price of admission. And, of course, that gives you more cash for fried foods, right? Fourth grader hosts garden party. There will be fashion models and artwork and plenty of other eye candy at Walk, the Runway Series fashion show, October 6 at North Hills. But the real star of the show will be Raleigh fourth grader William Winslow, better known as William the Food Drive Kid. All of the proceeds from the fall installment of Walk the Runway will be going toward William's efforts to match a grant he received from Sodexo to start a community garden at Ligon Middle School. William has taken on the challenge to help the Interfaith Food Shuttle's Backpack Buddies program increase its food supply for the Triangle area's hungry school children. Since 2013, William has held annual food drives, spoken at local schools and organizations, and raised $20,000 to support Backpack Buddies. Tickets are $25. Five Points Corner finally back to life. A building in the heart of Raleigh that had essentially been closed since Audio Buys closed in 2007 is back open at Five Points. Form and Function, a Raleigh interior design business, revamped the uniquely shaped building and held a grand opening September 24. We are very excited to bring this building back to life and offer a unique shopping experience to the Triangle, owner Carol Marcotte says. Now we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Amanda Hoyle. The first headline, Field and Stream folds in Triangle Market. Store and Carry is now closed. One of the first Field and Stream branded stores launched by sporting goods giant Dick's Sporting Goods at a new suburban Carry retail center in 2014 has decamped. Representatives of the company have not responded to questions about why the store closed after only 2 years at Parkside Town Commons, but the speculation is that sales at the Store and Carry weren't meeting projected goals as competition in the outdoor retail category exploded in the market over the past 2 years. The Carry Field and Stream was the fifth to open overall and first in the Southeast. Within a 16-month period in 2014 and early 2015, three major outdoor competitors to Field and Stream, including Cabela's, Bass Pro Shop, and Gander Mountain, each opened a new store in the region, and all are selling products geared toward hunting, fishing, and other outdoor activities. A recorded message at the Field and Stream store on O'Kelly Chapel Road in Cary as of September 26 directed all calls and questions to the Dick's Sporting Goods store on Crossroads Boulevard in Cary. A representative at the Dick's store in Cary confirmed that the Field and Stream store closed September 25, but he said he was unauthorized to make any further comment. Edward Stack, chairman and CEO of Dick's Sporting Goods, noted in a conference call with analysts in August that Field & Stream stores located in markets without a nearby Bass Pro Shop or Cabela's were performing better than stores that were competing in the same geographic region. They're both very good competitors, he said. Dick's Sporting Goods also owns the Golf Galaxy store that remains open at Parkside Town Commons. At the time of its opening, the store planned to hire about 100 employees to work full and part-time. Crabtree Valley Mall adding two new restaurants. Two new restaurant concepts already under construction at Crabtree Valley Mall will be aiming to draw younger clientele to one of the Triangle's most established retail centers. Seasons 52, A wine bar and restaurant owned by Darden Restaurants will be opening its first location in North Carolina at Crabtree. Restaurant and mall officials have confirmed. The new Seasons 52 is building out the space that Starbucks previously occupied near North Face on the Glenwood Avenue side of the mall, and also taking part of the space that Banana Republic vacated after it relocated. The new restaurant is set to open in spring 2017. The Starbucks has relocated to the second level near Sears. The second big change coming to Crabtree by mid-October will be a new concept and name for the Tomato Pie restaurant on the lower level. Tomato Pie owner Payman Bazuband, who also owns the Red Monkey restaurant and bar, says the closed Tomato Pie on September 25 says they closed Tomato Pie on September 25 and are changing the whole 4,200 square foot space into the Crabtree Beer Garden. Bazuband says they are perfecting a concept they started in April for the Briar Creek Beer Garden, which carries more than 50 beers on tap. The Crabtree spot will also have a bottle shop offering even more options. The mall is trying to target more millennials and young adults coming into the mall, and this will be targeting that group, he says. We're trying to open more of these neighborhood-type beer gardens, so we expect this will be the second of more like this. Holly Springs approves plan for a fresh market on Sunset Lake Road. Holly Springs Town Council on September 20 unanimously approved plans for Raleigh Development Company D&N Development to build a new fresh market anchored retail center on Sunset Lake Road. Construction of the new center, Holly Lakes, is expected to start in late November, with retailers expected to open in late 2017. Other retailers at the center will include Pet Supermarket, Hand in Stone, and Lee Spa Nail Salon. Lidl, spelled L-I-D-L, breaks ground on First Triangle store. European grocery chain Lidl has officially broken ground on a location in Wake Forest about a year after the company first filed a site plan with the town. Charlie Yokley, assistant planning director of Wake Forest, confirms that construction is underway for a 36,000-square-foot grocery store at the southwest corner of NC-98 and South Main Street near the new Holding Village housing community. Lidl has also acquired land for new grocery stores in Raleigh, Cary, and Apex, and expects to have its first stores open in the U.S. by 2018. The housing cycle. Is Raleigh approaching its peak? According to a recent research report by the John Burns real estate consulting firm, the Raleigh housing market is nearing the top of a bell curve comparison of the 20 largest new home volume markets in the U.S., but still solidly in phase two, or expansion phase, of a five-phase housing cycle. Home values in Raleigh are at 13% above the market's prior pricing break pre-recession, which puts the Triangle market ahead of both Charlotte and Atlanta in the recovery curve. Atlanta home values are still about 1% below its market peak. And now we turn to the On Technology page, written by Lauren Onasorge. The main headline, Coach K's off-the-court project, a startup. Longtime Duke University basketball coach Mike Krzyzewski, better known as Coach K, is flexing his entrepreneurial muscles, co-founding a California startup. The company, dubbed Power Forward, is a subscription platform that, according to its Los Angeles-based CEO, Chrissy Gorman, aims to promote what Krzyzewski is all about, and it's not basketball. It's leadership, she says. Gorman, a Duke and Harvard Business School alumna, said in an interview that Krzyzewski approached the sports agency he works with, Creative Arts Agency, with the idea to create a content platform all about leadership skills. He went to them looking to do stuff beyond basketball, looking at longer in his career what he's going to do when he eventually, at some point, isn't coaching at Duke, she said. And he's always seen himself as a teacher of leadership. She wouldn't give any details on a customer count, nor would she say whether or to what extent Krzyzewski had financially backed the company. The actual product is a web-based content platform that profiles successful leaders, she said. I think at heart, Coach is really a storyteller, she said, adding that the platform highlights a lot of the lessons gleaned from his book, Beyond Basketball, Coach K's Keywords for Success, expert interactive content from influencers such as Krzyzewski intended to drive discussion, and it's aimed at companies looking to empower team leaders. In a statement, Krzyzewski said, "Since my time at West Point, leadership has been a core passion of mine and something I've taught my teams at Duke and USA Basketball. Power Forward captures the essence of many hardcore leadership principles I've shared with my players for decades and applies it to business teams. What energized me about Power Forward is the ability to share my own storytelling approach with an entirely new audience off the court in the corporate and startup communities." Other partners in the company include Eddie Q, Apple Senior Vice President, Peter Guber, Mandalay Entertainment Chairman and CEO, Bruce Karsh, Oaktree Co-Chairman, and Steve Pekluka, Managing Director of Bain Capital. Q, Karsh, and Pekluka are Duke graduates. Growth continues at RDU International. Raleigh-Durham International Airport continues to see increased traffic coming through its gates. In August, the airport reported a total enplaned passenger count of 481,903, a 10% uptick from the same time period in 2015, and international flights, boosted by the new direct service to Paris that launched in May, increased 18.8% to account for 12,089 of those travelers. Departures, too, are increasing. On average, 200 flights departed RDU each day in August, a 7.1% rise from the same time period in 2015, which saw an average of 187 departures. Franchise to help kids learn is coming to the Triangle. Zaniac, a Salt Lake City startup, is coming to the Triangle. Franchisees Joe Pepe and CJ Bouchard, who also own several Planet Fitness franchises in the area, are used to seeing their investments change lives. And that's part of what attracted them when they met Zaniac founder Paul Zane Pilzer. The other part, fatherhood. Bouchard found himself struggling to create technology problems for his son to solve. To have somebody who could take the time in a small group setting to really teach these young minds how to program and work within these parameters, this would be amazing, says Bouchard. Three Zaniac campuses are coming, with the first opening in December at 1202 Parkside Main Street in Cary. Investor says growth, not product, is key. Paul Singh, former partner of 500 Startups, knows exactly what you shouldn't do if you want his dollars. "If an entrepreneur spends more than half of our allotted time talking about the product, it's a huge, huge red flag," he says, before an October 3 trip to Wilmington. "There's going to be a million things that happen over the company's life cycle. You want to be investing in founding teams that understand that growth is all that matters. A founding team that focuses so much on the product, in my opinion, is at risk for running out of cash." His other big red flag? "When they try to get you to sign NDAs, non-disclosure agreements, before you even meet with them, that's ridiculous," he says. "It's 2016. How you acquire customers is your secret sauce. It's not what your company actually does." And finally, in a section called They Said It, the first quote is from Jim Goodnight, CEO of SAS, addressing the IT Architect Regional Conference Southeast in downtown Raleigh on September 23. "We have never stood still. We are always moving forward. It's 40 years since SAS was founded, and we continue to grow every year, and we'll be growing again this year." Frank Calderoni, CFO of Red Hat, talking about the firm's 2015 buy of Durham's open source automation firm Ansible. "Many companies, as they do acquisitions, struggle as far as the integration. That has been the complete opposite for us. Great alignment across Red Hat and the Ansible team globally." Jim Whitehurst, CEO of Red Hat, speaking after releasing analyst-beating earnings results. "I think budgets are relatively tight in IT, but that's in many ways good for us, as we're seeing as they partner to help carve out costs." Chuck Purvis, CEO of Coastal Federal Credit Union, talking about how putting the credit union's name on what used to be Walnut Creek Amphitheater is already seeing results. "It's definitely increased our visibility, and awareness in the market. And now we turn to the On Healthcare page written by Jennifer Henderson. The main headline, Company Treating Acne Has Successful IPO. Durham-based Novan, which is developing a treatment for acne without the use of antibiotics, closed its initial public offering September 26. The IPO consisted of more than 4.7 million shares, with underwriters exercising in full their option to purchase 615,000 of those, according to a release issued by the drug maker. Novan raised $51.9 million before underwriters' discounts and commissions, the release further stated. Novan priced its IPO at $11 per share and saw its stock soar on its first day of trading on the NASDAQ on September 21. Trading under the ticker symbol NOVN, Novan's stock hovered around $20 after its first day of trading. It closed September 28 at $22.54. Ireland's Malin Life Sciences Holdings Limited and Cree Incorporated co-founder and former Chief Executive Officer F. Neil Hunter are Novan's largest shareholders. The company is led by President and CEO Nate Stasko. Purchase means relocation to Cary for Paragen. Paragen. Paragen, a company based in Princeton, New Jersey that specializes in perinatal software, has acquired the Watch Child Fetal Monitoring System from Hillrom Holdings Incorporated. As a result, Paragen plans to relocate its corporate headquarters to Cary. The deal closed September 21, according to Catherine Tabaka, president of Hillrom's Patient Support Systems Specialty Products business. Financial terms of the transaction were not disclosed. Watch Child's 18-member Cary team will join Paragen, said a Paragen spokeswoman. Those employees will remain at the Cary outpost until Paragen secures a physical address of its own there, she said, noting that Paragen is currently looking for space. We're not sure yet who will be relocating to Cary. No attrition or layoffs are expected, the spokeswoman for Paragen said in an email. Prior to its acquisition of Watchchild, Paragen had a headcount of 55 employees, with 24 based in the U.S. Paragen also has 4 employees in Montreal and 27 in Israel. Paragen CEO Matthew Sapern will lead the combined Paragen and Watchchild entity, and Brian Bishop, the general manager of Watchchild, will serve as chief product officer. Campbell Law School starts free clinic in Raleigh. Campbell Law School has launched a community law clinic located at 11 South Blunt Street to help people in need. The clinic, funded by a $150,000 grant from the Z. Smith Reynolds Foundation, will offer free legal services to people facing challenges in areas like housing and employment, said Law Dean J. Rich Leonard. Raleigh Rescue Mission, Urban Ministries of Wake County, and Step Up Ministry will refer clients. Ashley Campbell of Ragsdale Liggett will lead the clinic. She said the goal is to fill the gap in serving people who are trying to improve their lives and have some legal issue that is preventing them from doing that. 8 third-year law students have registered for a 3-credit course, said Leonard. Often when people seek to improve their lives and secure housing and employment, unexpected legal problems arise, such as record searches from landlords and employers, Leonard said. The clinic can give advice on those issues. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to A Better World page written by Todd Cohen, who also publishes Philanthropy North Carolina. First, we'll start with his column, the headline, Major Addition at Rex Nears Completion. Before Rex Hospital moved in 1980 to its campus on Blue Ridge Road in Raleigh, it raised $4 million in a capital campaign to develop the new campus. In the past 2 years, the Rex Healthcare Foundation has generated $8.6 million in cash and pledges in the quiet phase of capital campaign to raise $10 million to help finance construction of a new heart and vascular hospital. The $235 million 8-story 114-bed facility, set to open in March, will consolidate services now spread among 7 locations on the campus. Now the foundation is kicking off the public phase of the campaign, its first since 1980. After focusing on leadership gifts of $50,000 or more in quiet phase and generating donations from about 200 donors, the public phase will focus on smaller gifts, particularly from individuals and families. The public phase aims to net at least $100,000 from the Rex Gala on November 12 at the Raleigh Convention Center. Chairing the campaign is Dr. Tift Mann, a retired cardiologist from Wake Heart and Vascular, now North Carolina Heart and Vascular, a Raleigh-based practice of about three dozen cardiologists that is the largest in Wake County. It joined UNC Rex Healthcare in 2011 and serves Wake and eight other counties, mainly south and east of Wake. UNC Rex Healthcare, formed in 2000 through the merger of Rex and UNC Healthcare in Chapel Hill, has seen growing demand for heart and vascular services, says Alan Wolf, the Rex manager of media relations. Fueling the rising demand, he says, was a spike in referrals after the merger with North Carolina Heart and Vascular, and after UNC Healthcare's affiliation with hospitals in other counties, as well as the region's booming population and emergence as a destination for retirees and aging boomers. UNC Rex also is getting many referrals from hospitals not affiliated with the UNC Healthcare system. In 2015 alone, 1,804 cardiovascular-related patients were transferred to UNC Rex from hospitals in eight other counties. Amy Daniels, director of the Rex Healthcare Foundation, says the consolidation of heart and vascular services in the new 306,000-square-foot facility will make it easier for patients to get the care they need. The new facility also has been designed to foster efficiency and innovation, she says. Rather than sharing elevators, for example, families and visitors will use public elevators, while caregivers and staff transporting patients will use clinical elevators, including two that can handle patients and trauma equipment and teams of up to 20 people. And a training facility to be located in a space known as the Center for Innovation and Learning will include a demonstration kitchen for classes focusing on wellness and prevention. The goal is to keep people out of the hospital, Wolf says. We're really hoping the facility will be a place where people can come before they get sick to learn how not to get sick. And in nonprofit news, Y program gets hand from SAS tournament. A YMCA program designed to help young children learn gets a big hand each year from the SAS championship. This year, the SAS tournament is at Prestonwood Country Club on October 11 through 16. Since 2000, proceeds from the event have contributed to the Y Learning program of the YMCA of the Triangle. The program provides free tutoring to children in grades K through 8 who need academic help. Since 2000, more than 7,200 kids have benefited. The Y Learning students visit the SAS championship to learn about potential careers and meet players. We are so grateful for the support from SAS and the SAS championship, says Bruce Hamm, YMCA of the Triangle Chief Development Officer. Students in Y Learning receive daily homework assistance and academic support that they couldn't afford otherwise. Your wish is granted. A Wake County girl got her wish when she flew from Raleigh-Durham International Airport to Disney World with her family, September 22. Granting Malia's wish were Make-A-Wish, Eastern North Carolina, and American Airlines. Malia, 3, was one of 10 children visiting Orlando, Florida, for a week. And finally, learn about adoption. The Methodist Home for Children in Raleigh is hosting information sessions about adopting and fostering children. On October 12, the home will host a foster care and adoption information session from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at 1041 Washington Street. You have to register in advance to attend. Then, on October 22, the organization will host an adoption awareness party from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. The event will include speakers discussing the value of adoption, information on adoption resources, and activities for children. Lunch will be provided. Registration is required by October 14. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page, and we'll start with the guest column written by Marcellus Davis, who is a financial advisor at Morgan Stanley and is based in Houston. The headline of the article, or his guest column, Business Cycle Matters More Than Politics. It's election season, And with the 2016 campaigns in full swing, we are inundated with the latest in presidential politics on a daily basis. This has left many investors wondering how the presidential election may affect the markets and, ultimately, their portfolios. Morgan Stanley conducted a study based on historical data to explore the relationship between the markets and presidential elections. As a financial advisor, I'm often asked about this top-of-mind issue by investors, and many may be surprised by the findings of the study. Research suggests that regardless of which candidate or party wins, it has less of an impact on the markets than where we are in the business cycle. While presidential elections tend to take over the headlines, odds are they won't ignite the markets in any long-term way. The research suggests that regardless of which candidate or party wins, it has less of an impact on the markets than where we are in the business cycle. While over full presidential terms, stocks have historically done better when a Democrat is in office, much of this has to do with timing in the business cycle rather than policy decisions. We've found that higher returns are a result of economic recovery and expansion, while lower returns are associated with economic downturn and repair. Looking at historical data during election years, the S&P 500 has averaged 7% price return since 1928, with energy, financials, and healthcare sectors historically outperforming in those years. Additionally, research indicates that the summer months typically outperform during election years relative to non-election years. In sum, the question investors should be asking themselves is not what happens to the markets if a certain candidate is elected, but rather they should direct their attention to where we are in the business cycle. While many may get caught up in the political banter, remember that the markets are the largest driver of portfolio performance, not those running for the White House. And in our other Viewpoint article, it's written by Tammy Tierney, who is Vice President of Communications and Employee Development at American City Business Journals. The headline, Office Culture, When You Always Win, You Lose. When you're convinced you're always right, there's an awful lot that can go wrong. You probably have a colleague, there seems to be one in every office, who takes pride in prevailing in every difference of opinion, whether in the boardroom or the break room. Beating back all challenges offers perceived short-term wins, but as a long-term strategy, it's a loser that damages relationships. Righteous rightness makes you see everyone as an adversary. Treating them that way dampens any desire they may have to compromise and collaborate. Extinguishes enthusiasm. Fear of making mistakes and being criticized puts people in a defensive posture that kills creativity. Without the freedom to test new concepts and try fresh approaches, many staffers simply check out. Prevents progress. Wrangling over every phase of a project is exhausting. The team gets tense and the work gets stalled. Potentially lucrative ideas never surface because people's time, energy, and interest are consumed by petty squabbles. When you see work as a zero-sum game, every conversation could become confrontational, every interaction devolve into a dispute. Before you throw down the gauntlet, ask, is this really worth arguing over? Your budget proposal deserves a vigorous defense. The appetizers ordered for an office party? Probably not. What happens if I walk away? Sometimes the best way to end a tug of war is to just drop your end. If the idea being debated is as unsound as it seems, you won't be the only one who notices. Could compromise bring benefits? The colleague you're battling with today could be the very person whose support you need tomorrow. If it's someone you'll work with often, strive for a solution you can both live with. Ideas need air. To be exchanged, examined, and thoughtfully, even passionately debated until an answer emerges. That's impossible when one side's sucking up all the oxygen. And now we'll turn to the People on the Move page, and the spotlight is on Dinah Jeffries, Emergency Services Director for Orange County. Armed with more than three decades of experience in the emergency services field, Dinah Jeffries has now been named Director of Emergency Services for Orange County. Jeffries began her career as a 911 telecommunicator in 1983. She subsequently served as a training specialist for a number of years and continued to move up through the ranks in the emergency services field. Previously, Jeffries served for about 8 months as Interim Director of Orange County Emergency Services. Prior to that, she was Deputy Chief of the organization. "I very much enjoy this business," Jeffries says. "And though I have 33 years in this profession, I have so much more to give. It seemed natural to continue challenging myself and supporting my county." In her current role as director, Jeffries is responsible for leading and managing 4 divisions of emergency services, including 911 telecommunications, fire marshal, emergency medical services, and emergency management. The biggest responsibility, she says, is assuring that her team has the tools needed to be successful and to work closely with its partners and community to provide a safe and secure environment for all. Orange County Emergency Services Department employs 133 full-timers and 23 temporary workers. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? How dedicated and highly trained these professionals are. Orange County is very fortunate to have forward-thinking and customer-oriented employees in emergency services. We are one of the few counties who have all of these services under one roof, as well as a single answering point for the citizens. What are some of your major goals in your new position? Continue building a team that embraces the values and ethos of the agency and county, and guiding our entire team to take ownership of everything we do. I believe in allowing them to make decisions and step out front as leaders. Biggest pet peeve? I have a few, but my biggest pet peeve is dishonesty. Biggest worry? Not doing enough for my team. Education, bachelor's degree in human services from Elon University. And now we turn to the general news section. The headline, Entrepreneur Finds New Life for Old Tires. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onasorge. After FastMed Urgent Care sold, its founder, Jason Williams, found his next startup, Franklinton-based Product Recovery Technologies International, and the company just raised $10 million in equity financing to turn old tires into commodities. The same tires collecting mosquito larvae and rainwater in ditches across the country can be demanufactured into oil, carbon, and gas, the parts they were constructed with, Williams says, and those items in turn can be sold for a profit, he contends. So far, 81 investors have contributed, according to a securities filing. When Williams first latched on to the concept last year, he found himself wanting to lead PRTI, taking on the CEO role and getting to work. "I am all in," he said in an interview. "This is what I'm doing now." When comparing the new company to FastMed, "It's not really that different," he insisted, calling it an infrastructure company. Just as FastMed exists in the space between your primary care doctor and an emergency room, PRTI exists within microgrids, augmenting the legacy power grid and providing, quote, "a real stable power source," unquote, he says. "Really, the sky is the limit in regards to the opportunity." PRTI's newly built plant, which is on about 6 acres in Franklinton, just north of Raleigh, can deconstruct about 1.5 million tires per year, he said. Tires come from a variety of sources, all waste tires, William says. "They'd normally end up in a landfill or would be illegally dumped, and we're able to recycle them," he says. "I produce a lot of power by using a little bit of power, and I use waste streams like synthetic polymers to do it." Once they go through the patented process, those same tires, typically filling up landfills, become oil headed for New York, where it's traded as a commodity for fuel. Steel goes to a recycler in Garner. Carbon goes to other buyers and brokers. And that's just the start. As Williams confirmed, the 18-employee firm is in the throes of discussing a power contract with North Carolina's largest utility company, Charlotte-based Duke Energy. Duke is in talks to purchase both oil and gas that could be used to power generators, he says. According to a securities filing, the $9.7 million in equity is an add-on to a $3 million round the company closed late last year. Williams says the Bulk of the investment dollars are local, though he won't disclose the backers. Williams hopes to see PRTI's success rival that of FastMed. The plan is a national rollout, he says. FastMed has 87 clinics in North Carolina and Arizona when it sold last year. Date set for first flight to Cuba from North Carolina. This article written by Jenna Martin. A historic flight is set to depart from Charlotte Douglas International Airport en route to Havana later this fall. American Airlines, one of 8 U.S. carriers to receive federal approval for commercial air travel to Havana, will offer its first flight from Charlotte Douglas International Airport to Havana on November 30. American spokeswoman Katie Cody said September 27. Tickets for the nearly 3-hour flight are on sale on American's website, with main cabin round-trip fare priced at about $500. An Airbus 319 is scheduled to take passengers from CLT, leaving just past noon and arriving in Havana at about 2:50 p.m. The flight back from Havana will leave at 3:45 p.m. and land at 6:18 p.m. That initial flight will be followed by American's once-daily service between CLT and Havana. The U.S. and Cuba signed a deal earlier this year restoring commercial flight service between the two countries for the first time in 50 years, but travel is limited to family visits, government business, journalistic and educational activities, and other non-tourism purposes. On August 31, air travel to Cuba officially began when JetBlue Airways Corporation sent a plane from Fort Lauderdale-Hollywood International Airport to Santa Clara, Cuba. A week later, American became the second U.S. carrier to land a commercial flight in Cuba, in Cienfuegos, in more than 5 decades. About that same time, the U.S. Department of Transportation made official its decision to grant commercial flights between the U.S. and Cuba to American Airlines, Alaska Airlines, Delta Airlines, Frontier Airlines, JetBlue Airways, Southwest Airlines, Spirit Airlines, and United Airlines. Besides Charlotte, the selected carriers will be flying from Los Angeles, New York, JFK, Atlanta, Fort Lauderdale, Orlando, Miami, Tampa, Florida, Newark, New Jersey, and Houston. Massive expansion coming at Triad's Red Oak Brewery. This article is written by Katie Arcieri. Red Oak Brewery, one of the Triad's largest breweries, is planning to expand its eastern Guilford County facility with a multi-phase project that includes a beer hall and a beer garden. Company owner Bill Sherrill could not be reached for comment by the Triad Business Journal to discuss construction timelines, total investment, and potential new jobs, but Guilford County planner Dervin Spell confirmed that the brewery submitted site plans in May for a 28,150-square-foot addition to the company's building located at 6901 Conica Drive in Whitsett. Chris Buckley, Red Oak's brewmaster, stated in an email to the Triad Business Journal this week that the company's expansion is a multi-phase project whose first phase includes a beer hall and garden, a second phase for an art gallery, and a third phase for a packaging facility that will include a canning operation. Company employee Megan Willits, who works in customer service at Red Oak, said she expects the addition to open within a year and a half. She said the brewery offers tours on Fridays, but there is currently no place for customers to socialize and have beers. The addition will offer customers a chance to, quote, hang out here at the brewery and enjoy beer in the beer garden, she said, unquote. I think it will be good for the public, she said. The Triad is home to more than a dozen craft breweries, including 3 of the state's 5 largest breweries. And finally, in this news section, we'll read from a section called Getting Involved. EY Volunteer Day. On September 30, Ernst & Young LLP employees from Raleigh were scheduled to donate 1,000 volunteer hours to local nonprofits as part of EY Connect Day, the firm's annual day of service. Some of the organizations benefiting from the day include Reaching All Minds Academy in Durham and the Food Bank of Central and Eastern North Carolina. Mike Murdy, office managing partner, says EY Day allows our people to connect with each other, strengthen existing community relationships, and form new ones. Abilities Tennis Event, the Abilities Tennis Association of North Carolina, which provides opportunities for adults and kids with intellectual disabilities to play tennis, is holding its Footprints on the Court event October 7 at North Hills Club in Raleigh. The event begins at 5 p.m. and features round-robin tennis, dinner from the Carolina Ale House, and a silent auction. A party with a band follows. The event raises money to provide clinics and tournaments across the state for those with intellectual disabilities. The cost is $50 for tennis players and $25 for fans. And with our remaining minutes, we'll read as much as we can of the executive voice featuring Brian Ralph. The headline, Pacing the Turnaround at William Peace University, written by Cameron Snipes. Brian Ralph took over as the 11th president of William Peace University in Raleigh in August 2015, just before the start of the 2015-2016 academic school year. And since then, he has been working to bring the university into its next phase by adding majors, sports, and boosting its overall clout in the community. Ralph is the school's 8th male president, though it had been guided by women since 1998. Laura Carpenter Bingham, a 1977 graduate, led what was then known as Peace College from 1998 through 2010. He succeeded Deborah Townsley, who retired at the end of the previous school year. Townsley led WPU through its biggest transition as it welcomed its first class of male students after being an all-women's college for 152 years. The decision was met with criticism by some alumni, though others recognized the financial hardships of a small college, particularly after the recession. The university's first male students matriculated in the 2012-2013 academic year. Ralph intends to continue that trend and put in place measures to further showcase diversity throughout the school's 21-acre campus located downtown. And we'll stop there as we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.